Moscow says Ukrainian soldiers of the besieged Azovstal steel plant in the port city of Mariupol have surrendered. Plus, Britain saying it will unilaterally change the terms of post-Brexit trade deal for Northern Ireland. This amid EU warnings that unilateral action will have consequences. This is World News from our Tehran headquarters. Saab Erus Najafi. Welcome. The top story this hour, the Russian Defense Ministry says its missiles have destroyed U.S. and European arms shipments to Ukraine's western Lviv region. Lviv is located near the Polish border and is the main entry point for military hardware sent by the West. The ministry also confirmed that more than 250 Ukrainian fighters in Mariupol's Azovstal steel plant have laid down their arms and surrendered. They'd been trapped in the plant for more than 2 months. Russia is now in full control of Mariupol. In the north, a Russian airstrike on a village in the Chernihiv region has killed 8 people, wounding a dozen more. The war in Ukraine began in late February. Now, while the conflict in Ukraine continues, John Miller has traveled to the Petrovsky district near the front line in Donetsk to investigate reports on the shelling of Donbass civilians by the Ukrainian army.
Petrovsky, a district of Donetsk. The front line is only a few kilometers away. The Ukrainian army has been shelling the district since 2014, and since the war with Russia began, the shelling has intensified. A school. 2 shells landed yesterday in the playground.
Yesterday in the morning, approximately from 8 until 9, 2 missiles hit here, from either Novomikhailovka or Krasnogorovka. You could hear some whistling and 2 explosions. One hit the big tree over there, another hit over here. And 18 windows in the school were damaged.
The janitor cleans up the glass from the shattered windows to the sound of outgoing artillery fired by the Donbass separatists.
The janitor at that school told us that another school had been hit just a few hours ago in Petrovsky, so we're going there now to see what damage has been done.
A branch blown off and shattered glass. It is fortunate the children here are currently learning from home.
I found some shrapnel, deadly pieces of shrapnel that will kill or injure anybody nearby. And it's strange here seeing people still walking about and looking out their windows. At any time, one of these missiles could hit them.
Another recent strike on an apartment building. 2 people were confirmed killed. 20 meters away, children play. Since 2014, over 100 children have been killed by Ukrainian shelling, and over 14,000 people in total. We hear of more shelling today on some houses.
No, my house was hit on 3rd of May. Not today. Not directly my house, but my fence was damaged by shrapnel. Today house number 30 was hit. Let's go.
A few houses along, another fence destroyed.
What happened? The shooting started and we couldn't understand where it was from. Then we heard a rustling sound. It was above our heads. It hit once, twice, the third, then the fourth hit here. I saw the smoke and thought there was a fire.
While thousands of people have left Petrovsky, many, like Yulia, prefer to stay. They have nowhere else to go and prefer living under shelling than becoming refugees.
What can I say? It happens often. There are many places hit, not only here, but near the roundabout, the big supermarkets, and people die every day. When will it end?
So, why do you not leave here?
Where should we go? It's our earth, our ground, our houses are here. Why should we go anywhere? We didn't go to shoot at anyone. We have always been here. For what reason they shoot at us?
It's difficult to explain just how strange it is here in Petrovsky district. The people who are still here are leaving their lives in the hands of God or chance. Every day there are dozens of missile strikes here. While it's quiet at the moment, there's usually the constant rumble of incoming and outgoing artillery.
While the vast majority of shelling in this war is being done by Russia, who currently have air and artillery superiority, the uncomfortable truth is that Ukraine is also killing civilians. indeed as it sees it, its own civilians. And they have been doing so for the last 8 years. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
The Russian president says it's impossible for some European countries to completely shun Russian oil imports for now. And that's because the European Union is proposing an embargo. Vladimir Putin says that those states are so heavily reliant on energy imports that they cannot ditch Russian oil for a long time. Putin made a comment in a televised meeting with a group of domestic oil managers and government officials. The Russian president also noted that Western sanctions and a possible embargo on Russian oil have pushed up global prices and has stoked inflation across Europe itself. Now, the comments came as EU members are negotiating oil embargoes on Russia over its war with Ukraine. The latest round of talks between the bloc's foreign ministers failed this week due to a veto from Hungary that's heavily dependent on Russian oil. Finland's parliament has overwhelmingly approved the government's proposal to apply for membership of the U.S.-led NATO military alliance. 188 lawmakers in the 200-member parliament voted in favor of NATO membership. Foreign Minister Pekka Haavisto said that his country, along with Sweden, would submit applications to NATO on Wednesday. The announcement marks a dramatic shift in Finland's decades-old military non-alignment policy. Meanwhile, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has expressed his opposition to Finland and Sweden's joining the bloc. The two Nordic countries require Turkey's support, as all NATO members must agree to their bid. Russia has repeatedly warned Stockholm and Helsinki against the move. Moscow sees NATO's eastward expansion as a direct threat to its security. The UK has announced plans to alter the terms of the post-Brexit trade deal for Northern Ireland, despite EU warnings against any unilateral action.
I am announcing our intention to introduce legislation in the coming weeks to make changes in the protocol. Our preference remains a negotiated solution with the EU. And in parallel with the legislation being introduced, we remain open to further talks if we can achieve the same outcome through negotiated settlement.
The UK Foreign Secretary says that a bill will be introduced in Parliament in the coming weeks to make changes to the so-called Northern Ireland Protocol. But she added that a legislative solution is not about scrapping the protocol, and it will remain in consistence with Britain's obligations under international law. The Northern Ireland Protocol was part of the UK's divorce deal with the EU. It effectively created a customs border in the sea between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK to prevent a hard border on the island of Ireland. The EU says that any unilateral UK action on the protocol represents a clear breach of international law. It's warned that it will respond with all measures at its disposal in case the UK goes ahead with the alterations.
It was supposed to ensure a seamless post-Brexit trade between the UK and the EU. Instead, the Northern Ireland Protocol, in place since last year, is now in danger of falling apart, and with it, peace on the island. The most recent reason, the outcome of the elections in Northern Ireland earlier this month. The Republican Party, Sinn Féin, came top for the first time ever. The country has a system of power sharing between Republicans who want Northern Ireland in the Republic of Ireland and Unionists who want it to remain in the UK. And the second largest party in these elections, the Democratic Unionist Party, refuses to accept the protocol, saying it undermines its position in the UK.
This protocol is bad for the economy of Northern Ireland. It's bad for the economy and the Union of the United Kingdom. And in our view, it is that Union of the United Kingdom which shelters Northern Ireland, protects Northern Ireland, provides opportunities for Northern Ireland.
This is the Irish Sea border for trade, enshrined in the Northern Ireland Protocol, part of the post-Brexit withdrawal agreement aimed at avoiding a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. The unionists here say they want the protocol scrapped altogether. Westminster now says it's prepared to make changes to parts of it, but to the EU, that is anathema.
The unionists say they're not entering into government with Sinn Féin if the protocol isn't resolved. And the EU says renegotiating an international agreement such as the protocol is simply not acceptable.
Unilateral action, effectively disapplying the protocol, is not the solution for the way forward. The Commission stands ready to continue working in this way because our ultimate goal is to protect the Good Friday Belfast Agreement in all its dimensions, and we urge the UK to do the same.
The UK has so far not budged. Instead, it's now threatening once again to pull the plug on the protocol altogether, leaving many wondering why it signed up to it in the first place.
Boris Johnson clearly wanted to get Brexit done, and so he promised just about anything to the unionists to get them to agree. At the same time, the unionists had a vested interest in staying good friends with the British, the Westminster government, because a rift with them would be very damaging for the unionist cause. Now they've got to live with those consequences.
It's a difficult, self-inflicted conundrum for the UK government led by Prime Minister Boris Johnson on a visit to Belfast trying to break the impasse. On the one hand, he has to satisfy the unionists to protect power sharing and that 1998 peace deal that put an end to decades of sectarian violence between the Republicans and unionists in Northern Ireland, and on the other, avoid a trade war with the European Union. Saeed Purza, Belfast, Northern Ireland.
The European Commission has sharply revised down its economic growth forecast for both the European Union and the Eurozone in 2022. It's also almost doubled estimate for inflation compared to its February readings. Now, we've discussed that issue in depth in our news review program.
Welcome to another edition of the News Review. Russia's war in Ukraine is taking a heavy toll on Europe's economy. The European Commission has now slashed its expectations for the Eurozone's growth while increasing its inflation forecast for the Monetary Union. The EU's executive arm cut the annual growth for both the bloc and the Eurozone to 2.7, blaming soaring energy prices. The figure is down from the previous forecast of 4%. It also predicted that consumer prices in the euro area will go up by 6.1% year on year. That is a near doubling of the previous forecast of 3.5%. The European Commission also hiked the expected inflation for the EU much higher than its earlier forecast. The Commission warned that the forecast is subject to high uncertainty and risks, noting that it could worsen further if Russia completely cuts off its oil and gas supplies to Europe. For more on that, we are joined by our correspondent Jerome Hughes, who is joining us live from Brussels, and also Rodney Shakespeare, professor of economics from London. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen. Let's begin with Jerome Hughes. Now, Jerome, of course, we saw in your reports that these sanctions that were imposed by the European Union on Russia is now backfiring on Europeans themselves. And now we see in these economic reports, as I told you, the forecasts that are now being considered. Can you please tell us more about the economic situation that the Eurozone will be facing?
Indeed. Well, perhaps it's more practical and more beneficial to focus on what actually is happening as opposed to these forecasts, because I think there's a general consensus that the forecasts are not worth the paper they're written on. I mean, even a month ago, you'll remember Christine Lagarde, the head of the European Central Bank, which manages the euro currency. She said, you know, when asked about how bad could things go, she said, quote, "Who knows?" So really, there's no way of knowing what could happen. But what we do know for sure is in the past year on year, energy prices in the Eurozone increased by 38% in April, and they've certainly increased since then. And to put a sort of a real example on that, if you bought 200 litres of home heating oil in April, it would cost €275. If you buy 200 litres of home heating oil today, it's going to cost €300. So it's even in 1 month, it's gone up by €25. And that's right across the board when you're talking about home heating oil, but you're talking about, you know, fuel for cars as well, and the knock-on impact as well, because a lot of the gas generates electricity, so electricity prices have gone up. So really, things are in a very bad they're in a very bad state as we speak. But these forecasts could be overly optimistic. There's no doubt about that, because as Christine Lagarde says, who knows what happens if Russia decides to cut off all of the gas supply
exactly.
to the EU.
Exactly. All of this is happening, Jerome, while Russia has not cut off its oil and gas supplies just yet. So let's bring in Rodney Shakespeare to see what will European Union be looking at if that happens, Professor.
Well, this is weird. They've gone completely mad. There's more sense in Alice in Wonderland. You've asked me about Russia cutting off the supplies of oil and gas. Who is trying to cut off the supplies of Russian oil and gas? Who is sanctioning Russia in the endeavour to do this? And then talks about what happens if Russia cuts off the supplies of oil and gas. Their logic and their grasp of reality has absolutely collapsed. They are now in a mental state of trying to destroy Russia and to say and do anything. As regards these figures of growth, what growth? When your inflation is officially 6, it's really 12, going up to 15 or 20. In the UK today, they're talking about 10, it'll soon be 15 or 20. Where is the growth? Have any of these people even gone to the local supermarket and done any shopping? They are now saying and doing anything, and their minds are going round in a whirl of hatred. And they've lost control of the situation, and all I can say is this is going to hit the people and the citizens of Europe. It's going to hit them worse and worse, and there is no solution to it coming from these elitists at this moment.
Mr. Shakespeare, do you believe that the euro will fall against the ruble even more, and will the ruble become more valuable eventually, a more valuable currency?
Well, I heard Jerome refer to a seventh round of sanctions. Well, I'd rather not even think what's going on. There's a very key point about the Russian economy. It's ultimately related to commodities. And that contrasts with the Western financial system, which is now a finance capitalism, which is concerned with money manipulations and not the real economy and actual outcomes. And these chickens are coming home to roost. And it led to the arrogance which thought that they could do anything to Russia and the Russian ruble will collapse. What has happened is that the Russian ruble, I believe, is actually stronger than what it was before the military operation started. So surprising things are happening, and these people in Brussels and in the UK, they are all over the place, and the people are going to suffer as a consequence.
Thank you very much. That was Rodney Shakespeare, professor of economics from London, and also our correspondent Jerome Hughes from Brussels. Thanks to both of you gentlemen for sharing your views with us.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Nakba or catastrophe, as that black day in history is called, saw illegal Jewish migrants from Eastern Europe drive away around 1 million Palestinians, both Muslims and Christians, from their homes and hearths after massacring many Arabs and razing villages to rubble. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Kayhan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading Usurper Israel's Fast Approaching End. Here's the story. Mankind may have mastered science and technology and is trying to explore outer space, but it is neither in control of its dangerously destructive tendencies that it disrupt its delicate nature, nor does it make any attempt at soul-searching to discover its innate self that is unrelated to human anatomy and falls within the realm of the spirit. As a result, despite industrial progress and material amenities, which the nexus of the politicians and the scientists have for long misused, the world continues to be a hate-filled place where crimes gather and terrorism rules the roost. This alienation from humanitarian values and lust for satanic sentiments led to ignorance of the teachings of the prophets of God, an emergence of such mass murderers as Nimrod, the Pharaoh, Attila, the Genghis Khan, and later history of genocidal regimes, the most murderous, along with the now defunct Baathists of Saddam, being the illegal Zionist entity that was planted in Palestine in mid-May 1948. Nakba or catastrophe, as that black day in history is called, saw illegal Jewish migrants from Eastern Europe drive away around 1 million Palestinians, both Muslims and Christians, from their homes and hearths after massacring many Arabs and razing villages to rubble. In the preceding 2 years, waves of European Zionist terrorists had indulged in the near-total destruction of the harmonious Muslim-Christian society, seizing some 78% of historic Palestine, ethnically cleansing and destroying about 530 villages and cities, and killing over 15,000 Palestinians in a series of mass atrocities, including more than 70 organized massacres with British approval. It is now 74 years, and usurper Israel, with the support of the U.S. and West European regimes, continues its genocide, coupled with desecration of the holy sites of Islam and Christianity. On May 15th, on the heels of its cold-blooded murder of prominent Christian journalist Shirin Abu Aghile, whose funeral was savagely attacked and her coffin defiled, it unleashed armed gangs of illegal Zionist migrants to attack peaceful Palestinian protesters and to violate the sanctity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. This year, conscientious people of other religions, including many Jews, who consider the illegal birth of Israel against the tenets of Judaism and denounce the Zionists as godless, joined Muslims all over the world to commemorate the Nakba anniversary with placards in bold letters reading, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free." They seem to be echoing the call of the leader of the Islamic Revolution for the most logically peaceful solution that the UN and its manipulators are trying to ignore, despite the fact the massive road rallies, which on Saturday, May 13th in London, numbered over 10,000, and which on Sunday, May 14th, saw several thousand Arabs, Muslims and non-Muslims take to the streets of the U.S. cities, including New York, Boston, Washington and Michigan, the Canadian cities including Montreal and Toronto, and the Australian cities including Sydney and Melbourne, chant "Free, Free Palestine." Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has suggested a democratic referendum involving all indigenous inhabitants, including Muslims, Christians and Jews, but not the non-Semitic illegal Zionist migrants from Europe and the Americas, to set up a unified government for a single Palestinian state, stretching from the borders of Lebanon in the north to the Sinai Peninsula in the south, and from the banks of River Jordan in the east to the shores of the Mediterranean Sea in the west. If this gross historical wrong is not rectified, the Zionist regime will definitely meet an ignominious end more catastrophic than the Nakba, and the Zionists, irrespective of their origin, will rue the day they were born or had been misled by this devilish anti-Muslim, anti-Christian ideology, and anti-human ideology.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com ukraine.org/en.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
On May 15, 1948, the Zionist regime forced some 750,000 Palestinians to leave their homes and villages and expelled them into refugee camps that still exist in the occupied West Bank, Gaza, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. Armed Zionist forces massacred entire villages of men, women, and even children. That pushed rightful owners of Palestine to leave their homes and lands as they feared losing their lives. Consequently, that provided the ground for Zionists to establish the Israeli regime. The Palestinians were to suffer further when the West Bank and Gaza fell to the Israelis during the 1967 war, also known as the Six-Day War. Millions of Palestinians, including those displaced since 1948, found themselves under military occupation as well as further Israeli expansionism in their lands. Palestinians want the West Bank as part of a future independent Palestinian state, with East al-Quds as its capital. But Israel's settlement expansion and annexation plans have dealt a serious blow to any prospects of peace. The Gaza Strip has also been under an inhumane Israeli land, air, and sea siege since 2007, and witnessed three wars since 2008. More than 600,000 Israelis currently live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the West Bank and East al-Quds. That's while all Israeli settlement activities are illegal under international law. Every year, Palestinians reaffirm their right to return to their homes and villages in historic Palestine on Nakba Day. They hold annual rallies to commemorate decades of ethnic cleansing of their homeland by the Zionist regime to establish what's known today as Israel. This year, thousands of Palestinians and their supporters across the globe have taken to the streets to hold mass rallies in commemoration of the 74th anniversary of Nakba, or Catastrophe Day, and to condemn the recent killing of a veteran Palestinian journalist by Israeli forces. Shirin Abu Aghaleh was fatally shot by Israeli troops as she was covering an army raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the northern part of the occupied West Bank. Targeting the media organizations and journalists isn't an accident. This is systematic targeting of media to create a cloak of secrecy around Israeli crimes.
This is something that is extremely important because it is the part of the historical memory of a culture and people have been subjugated by an illegal occupation of an apartheid regime.
Thank you.
In an expression of solidarity with the people of Palestine, the Iranian Foreign Ministry stated that addressing the issue of Palestine should be the first and foremost issue for the Muslim world, saying any attempt by global Zionism to drive the issue into oblivion would be doomed to failure. The Iranian ministry also stated that the anniversary of Nakba puts on display the failure of international institutions and organizations to resolve one of the longest-running humanitarian and political crises in the world. Israel has managed to get away with its crimes for decades as it enjoys Washington's unwavering support. The U.S. provides the regime with billions of dollars in lethal aid every year. It also invariably uses its veto power at the United Nations to block the world body's anti-Israeli resolutions.
Well, I think that the complicity of basically the Western political class in its entirety and the media in the West is inseparable from the question of Israeli impunity. Israel knows full well that it can do whatever it wants, that it can kill journalists, that it can kill Palestinian children, that it can continue with administrative detention and systematic torture of Palestinian prisoners, and that they'll get away with it because they will never be sanctioned by any of the so-called Western democracies.
This has quietly encouraged the Tel Aviv regime to continue violating the rights of Palestinians and to displace them and to steal their land. But how long will the regime of Tel Aviv be able to extend its illegal existence through carnage and plunder? Former Israeli Premier Ehud Barak has expressed concern about Israel's survival, saying the entity will cease to exist before the 80th anniversary of its 1948 establishment. The ultra-conservative former premier's comments echo prevailing fears in the occupied territories. A recent survey of young Israeli adults found that nearly half of the population in the occupied Palestinian territories is not optimistic about Israel's future, with more than one-third of people thinking about migrating for jobs and better life. Many analysts have pointed to the theory of collapse from within regarding the future of Israel, citing three factors of economic crisis, poor security situation and social divisions for the imminent decline and fall of the regime.
On Wednesday, two journalists covering an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Jenin for Qatari broadcaster Al Jazeera came under attack. Ali Al Samoudi was shot in the back but survived. His colleague, Shireen Abu Akleh, however, wasn't as lucky. The reporter was shot in the head and was pronounced dead after being rushed to the hospital. The attack came despite them both wearing vests with the word press emblazoned on them.
It wants the image of absolute lawlessness and operating with impunity. What could be more criminal than the targeted assassination? And just to even to say how strongly the whole world feels and the outrage at the assassination of Shireen Abu Akleh.
Also, according to eyewitnesses, the attack was unprovoked as there was no confrontation between Palestinians and the regime's forces at the time of the assault on the journalists.
The occupation is murderous and criminal. They shot us for no reason. We, a group of journalists, were there wearing our full press uniform in addition to the helmets with the word press written in large letters, as big as the whole world. We were obvious. We made sure to walk right in front of the army patrols so that they can see us, and they saw us after we went to a road where there were no armed people, no civilians, and and there were no shooting and no incidents there. We were shocked by the shooting. I was lucky and I turned my back when the first bullet was shot and injured my back. They wanted to kill me. I was injured in my back and the second bullet shot my colleague Shireen and caused her death.
But the regime didn't spare Abu Akleh, even at her funeral. Israeli troops attacked mourners carrying the slain journalist's casket outside the hospital, causing the coffin to almost fall to the ground. She was later laid to rest in a cemetery in occupied East Al-Quds. The journalist's killing and the subsequent attack during her funeral were met with international condemnation, with Israel's closest ally, the United States, calling it, quote, deeply concerning. The United Nations human rights experts have called the incident a serious attack on the freedom of media and expression and called for a transparent investigation. The case of the journalist set to be brought to the International Criminal Court, a tribunal that has in the past attempted to probe Israel's rights violations and war crimes against Palestinians, but failed to do so, due to political pressure and sanctions from the United States. Israel's aggression against countries like Syria and Lebanon has also been protested in the international arena. But so far, the reactions from the international community have been limited to verbal support. That begs the question, will Tel Aviv face any accountability for its crimes?
Within international courts, because who controls international courts? And who controls the International Criminal Court while they're not even a signer to it? That's U.S. imperialism. So I don't think Israel will be brought to any kind of justice or accountability through this. But I think it's up to the people of the world. It's up to all honest reporters, journalists, and news services to make sure that this does not go unmarked.
Some observers also ascribe the intensified Israeli pressure on Palestinians to some Arab states' moves to normalize ties with the regime. The Arab states had claimed that their decisions would help the Palestinian cause, an excuse that has repeatedly proven to be nothing more than mere window dressing over the past 2 years. Many Palestinians believe that in the absence of any international accountability, resistance remains their only way forward.
A state of shock in America, especially among members of the Native American community, following the identification of over 500 student deaths at U.S. boarding schools. The deaths of Native American children were confirmed as part of the first stage of a federal study of boarding schools that operated for over a century. They were supposed to assimilate the indigenous children into white society between 1819 and 1969. The number of deaths could be only the tip of the iceberg, as the U.S. Interior Department warns that with further investigation, the number of known student deaths could climb to the thousands or even tens of thousands. The initial findings of the comprehensive study have turned a spotlight on the dark history of more than 400 Native American boarding schools notorious for brutal conditions. Hundreds of thousands of indigenous children were forced by the U.S. federal government to attend the institutions. The children were separated from their families by force, forbidden from speaking their languages, and often abused. A large number of them never returned home. The painful legacy of the notorious system operated by the government and churches has been felt deeply across Indian country and through generations. The high-profile federal review was ordered by U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland last year after the discovery of unmarked graves at the site of former residential schools in neighboring Canada.
So it's it's the same history, really. There's really the thing is, the United States had such a huge population of Native people such a wealth of anthropology. If you could imagine what anthropologists today would give to be able to hurriedly record all those languages and take pictures, but they're gone. You can't even record the dead civilizations. And if they were allowed to live, the earth would be so much wealthier. It's really just a terrible, terrible tragedy. That is the real genocide. That's genocide number one.
The U.S. Interior Department's report was released on Wednesday. It highlighted instances of beating, withholding of food and solitary confinement, and other forms of abuse at U.S. boarding schools. U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, whose grandparents attended such schools, seems to be very serious about the investigation. She has ordered her agency to fully investigate what remains of the evidence of the horrific abuses.
Now we are uniquely positioned to assist in the effort to recover the dark history of these institutions that have haunted our families for too long.
She says the consequences of federal Indian boarding school policies, including the trauma caused by the family separation and cultural eradication inflicted on generations of children as young as 4 years old, are heartbreaking and undeniable. Brian Newland, the Assistant Secretary of the Interior for Indian Affairs, believes further investigation is needed to better understand the lasting effects of the boarding school system on American Indians. Newland said there is not a single American Indian, Alaskan Native, or Native Hawaiian in the country whose life has not been impacted by the notorious boarding school system. Meanwhile, the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition warned that efforts to find the remains of the indigenous children must continue until the United States fully accounts for the genocide committed against Native American children. The latest findings are shedding light on the plight of Native Americans in the United States. They are still suffering from many problems, including racial discrimination. Pressure is mounting on the U.S. establishment to come to terms with and learn lessons from its dark past.
On May 10, 2021, Israel began an offensive on the Gaza Strip that went on for 11 days. The regime razed several buildings in the meantime, including a tower housing the bureaus of several news outlets, including Al Jazeera's. The bombings killed over 250 Palestinians in the besieged enclave, including dozens of women and children. But this time, unlike other incidents where Israel launched attacks on the Strip, Palestinian resistance movements struck back hard, killing at least 12 Israelis.
We have to remember that while there have been deaths on both sides, the deaths of Palestinians far outnumber those of the Israelis, probably by close to 1,000 to 1. So there is not a lot of importance given to Palestinian lives. This has been an ongoing, longstanding policy of the world. It's completely unjust. It ignores international law and human rights, but this has been the case. But any efforts to bring rights to the Palestinians, rights that they are entitled to by international law simply because they live, because they exist, will be opposed because no other country wants to risk its economic ties with Israel.
The conflict had been in the making for several weeks prior, when Israeli troops intensified their crackdown on Palestinians in the occupied Al-Quds during the holy Muslim month of Ramadan. The protests that had erupted at the regime's attempt to evict several families from the East Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah also escalated the tensions. The devastating conflict ended in an Egypt-brokered ceasefire that went into effect on May 21st. The battle, however, significantly altered the perceptions about the military capabilities of Israel and Gaza-based resistance groups. The 2021 confrontation is widely hailed as a victory for Hamas and other resistance movements in Gaza, not only militarily and on the ground, but also morally on an international level. Demonstrations in solidarity with the Palestinians in Gaza and the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood were held across the world. A wider and more diverse group of people around the globe called for an end to the conflict and Israel's aggression, which helped raise awareness about the plight of Palestinians to a much higher extent.
Israeli invisibility can mean a number of things. You're referring to militarily, but there's also the invincibility that it had for so many years as being seen as the victim, the innocent victim just trying to defend itself. That has certainly been shattered. People around the world, even if they support Israel, see Israel as the aggressor.
A year on, Tel Aviv is once again intensifying the pressure on the Palestinians. Israeli forces and settlers have repeatedly raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound over the past few weeks, a location that's considered Islam's third holiest site. In response, there has been a spike in the number of deadly Palestinian retaliatory operations across the occupied territories. Palestinians say the attacks are a natural response to Israel's desecration of Al-Aqsa, an issue they warn is their red line. The mounting tensions between Palestinians and Israelis are raising fears about another confrontation. But the events over the past couple of years have indicated that Palestinians will continue to fight for what they believe in and that they can inflict pain on the other side, too.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.